Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome back to the Prospect Interview, where we speak to the brightest minds and talk about the ideas that matter in politics, arts, and society. I'm Sonia Soda, a new associate editor at Prospect magazine, and on Monday I was joined by award-winning journalist and political columnist at The Times, Rachel Sylvester, to discuss the big question on everyone's minds: is it all over for Boris Johnson? From the first Partygate revelations in December, to the Met Police opening an investigation into potential COVID breaches this week, Boris Johnson's premiership has become mired in scandal. Last week, David Davis stood up in the Commons and told him to, for the love of God, go. The question is, will he? As she explains in her piece in the latest issue of Prospect, Rachel Sylvester certainly thinks so, as she describes Boris as a Heineken Prime Minister in a country that now has a hangover. The following conversation was recorded before it was announced that the Met Police would be launching an investigation into the Downing Street parties. At the time of recording this introduction on Tuesday afternoon, it looks like this is not set to affect the timing of the publication of Sue Gray's investigation into the Downing Street parties. So Rachel, so much has happened, it feels like, in the last 48 hours. It's been a very busy weekend politically. We're recording this on Monday and things could change pretty quickly. But I thought it would be great just to start by recapping what's happened in the last couple of days. Where are we with the Sue Gray report and then some of the other allegations that are floating around Westminster at the moment?
Well, it's hard to keep up, actually, isn't it? As if it wasn't enough that the Prime Minister was subject of this inquiry by Sue Gray into the Downing Street parties, which is putting enough pressure on him as it is. But then, subsequently, William Ragg, Conservative chairman of a select committee, has come out and accused the Whip's office of bullying and blackmail. And he's now gone to the police with those allegations. And then over the weekend, Nusrat Ghani, a former minister, suggested that she'd been told she'd lost her job as a minister because of what she called her Muslimness. And Downing Street has had to launch yet another inquiry into that. She said she told the Prime Minister what had been said to her, and he told her to go and speak to the party about it. But it was obviously, in her view, a government matter. It was involved with her government role. So it's a complete roller coaster, really, for the Prime Minister. And his position's looking increasingly perilous, I'd say.
And have we ever sort of seen a time in British politics where there's been this much stuff swirling round an embattled Prime Minister, or do you think this is the first time it's been this bad?
Well, you think back to the dark days of the Brexit wars, and Theresa May was in a very difficult position too. But I think what was different at that time, at least for a few months, was that her opponents couldn't agree on who should replace her. And they both had sort of strong ideological views against the potential. Both sides had strong ideological views against the potential candidate. So the Remainers didn't want to get rid of her because they feared a Brexiteer taking over. The Brexiteers didn't want to get rid of her because they feared a Remainer. So there was a kind of deadlock. Whereas now for Boris Johnson, there's a sort of pretty much uniform view that on the Tory benches in the Commons, So there's certainly a strong majority view that his authority is gone, his political and moral authority, and he's lost so much support in the country. It's very hard to see how he gets through this.
And do you think that that means that a vote of no confidence is imminent?
I think a lot of Conservative MPs are waiting until Sue Gray reports. But I think once she does come out with her report, unless she says something which absolutely categorically clears the Prime Minister, there will be a confidence vote. It's hard to see how she can avoid saying anything other than that there was a party and that he did go to the party at the very least, leaving aside all the sort of wider cultural questions. And in the end, I don't think she'll say exactly what should happen to him or try and pronounce on his fate. But I think a lot of Conservative MPs are just waiting for that moment as they feel that there has to be a sort of due process, if you like, but they have pretty much made up their minds that they're going to put in their letters once that report is out.
And what do we know about what role Dominic Cummings might play in all this?
Well, he, of course, is the worst possible enemy any leader or prime minister can have. I remember the first time I met Dominic Cummings, he was actually working for Ian Duncan Smith at the time, who was the Tory leader at that stage. And I remember him saying to me that Ian Duncan Smith, who was at that time his boss, was a complete Muppet, was his phrase, and absolutely hopeless.
He seems to think that of everyone he works for,
exactly.
Doesn't he?
I remember interviewing him once after he'd left government under David Cameron, and he said he was a sphinx without a riddle and absolutely laid into him as well. So Boris Johnson is the third Conservative leader he's worked for who he's gone for. And I think he won't rest until he's got rid of him. And the problem for Boris Johnson is he has a lot of WhatsApp messages, text messages. We don't know what photographs he's got, but he's got hard evidence of some of the things he's saying. And a motive to use them. He's the sort of best campaigner in British politics. And at the moment, his campaign is against the Prime Minister.
You talked about the difference between sort of the end of the May term and the feeling now in Parliament. And I thought it was interesting that you said that Boris Johnson has just sort of lost almost everyone in the parliamentary party. Why do you think that is?
Well, I spoke to one MP when I was writing the piece for Prospect, who said he was like a one-time code you get on your mobile phone when you have to make a financial transaction, and it only lasts for 8 minutes or whatever, and that Boris Johnson's leadership was for a particular time. It was at a time when the party really wanted to get Brexit done, get that over the line. It needed cheering up by a sort of staunch Eurosceptic. But now that moment had passed, this MP said to me. And he had been up in his constituency, which is a 70% Leaves constituency, you know, in the north of England. Yeah. And he said he'd spent the weekend fielding emails from constituents absolutely furious about the parties in Downing Street. And he said that it was, in fact, the most loyal Conservatives who were the most previously loyal Conservatives who were the most cross, because they felt that the Prime Minister was actually bringing their party into disrepute as well as himself. And somehow there's this sense among a lot of Tory MPs that the foibles of Boris Johnson and the sort of refusal or failure to follow the rules somehow taps into this kind of archetypal Tory brand problem about the Conservatives are the party of the rich, the Conservatives are an elitist, out-of-touch party. And a different MP said to me that Boris Johnson won because he persuaded the party and his country that he was on the side of working people, and that therefore the Tory party was on the side of working people. That was the extraordinary breakthrough he had in 2019 at the general election to build that 80-seat majority. But now these parties have completely blown that apart. It was always a myth, really, but that the parties have completely exploded that myth.
Mm. Yeah, you mentioned in your column that one of his allies was apparently going around telling people during the sort of lockdown that rules are for the little people. that really kind of encapsulates what you're just saying there, doesn't it?
Yeah, I remember hearing that at the time and thinking that is, it didn't surprise me because I do think that is what Boris Johnson thinks, but it's also pretty shocking. And I think the other thing that the problem with the Downing Street parties, which I know at one level it's incredibly trivial, you know, who drank what wine or who had what cheese. But it's about this sort of sense of the rules don't apply. And actually, the problem is that taps into a wider character flaw of Boris Johnson's. If you think about his handling of the Owen Paterson affair, the way he prorogued Parliament, the way he didn't sack Priti Patel when his own independent advisor found her guilty of bullying. There's been a succession of things, really, where he thinks the rules don't apply to him. And in a way, that's been his greatest political strength. He's sort of broken all the political rules to win this great majority. But now that's a different thing if it's the sort of the rules of wider society. And people, I think, aren't willing to accept that. And then because the voters are so disillusioned, then the Tory MPs inevitably pick up on that. They want a leader who's a winner. They backed Boris Johnson, not particularly because they loved him or respected him. They thought he was a winner. And as soon as it looks like he's not a winner anymore, they'll dump him.
So it sounds like he's got quite a shallow relationship with his party. You mentioned in your piece that he could be sort of seen as a Heineken prime minister. What did you mean by that?
Well, he was always described as the sort of Heineken politician, the politician who could reach out to parts of the country that other conservatives couldn't reach. I remember Linton Crosby once saying to him, me, when he was London mayor, that he was a multi-grain politician in a white bread age, that there was something sort of interesting and intriguing and entertaining about Boris Johnson. He was a different kind of politician. And he had that kind of reach to, he reached into the former Labour seats that make up what we call the Red Wall, and he managed to reach into the sort of traditional Tory shires, and he created that coalition. But then the problem is that both sides now of that coalition are losing faith with him. So it's a kind of, that's why I said it was a bit like the Heineken hangover, or the Heineken can falling apart, however you want to describe it. But I think that that sort of winning touch has evaporated. And if in some ways the sort of Heineken ability to reach out to people has been the same thing that's turning people off now. So I spoke to one Labour strategist who'd been running focus groups among female voters. And the things that had been charming and entertaining about Boris Johnson, you know, the sort of ruffle, scruffy hair, the unkempt appearance, the slightly shambolic way of speaking, they had been charming previously and sort of rather entertaining. Now they were absolutely infuriating to those same women. And this strategist said it was a little bit like falling out of love. The things that were particularly endearing at the beginning of a relationship were the things that were absolutely maddening at the end.
I'm sure we've all been there.
So I think it's that sort of Heineken ability has just evaporated.
And why do you think it's happened? It does feel like it's happened really quickly, doesn't it? If people had been saying 6 months ago, oh, you know, Johnson's ratings would be down in the doldrums, it would have been quite hard to believe, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think the reason it's happened so quickly, I think, is because the specific incidents around the party do tap into the wider problem for Boris Johnson and the Tory party. So it looks like a sort of isolated incident, but actually it's part of a pattern. But I think the reason the Downing Street parties are so toxic is because it's such a sort of human, understandable phenomenon that cuts through to people. I spoke to one Tory peer who said it was a little bit like the Millie Dowler phone hacking incident that led to the closure of the News of the World. It was something that everybody, every family in the country could understand. Everybody had made sacrifices during the lockdown. Everybody hadn't seen friends, hadn't gone to funerals, had missed family, hadn't been having drinks parties in the garden because we'd all been told not to. So there was something incredibly human and understandable about that form of breaking the rules, which is why it cut through so dramatically. Yeah. But I think it tapped into a sort of wider problem and a bigger truth, if you like, about Boris Johnson, which is why it's so toxic.
And the sort of other couple of breaking stories that we've had in the last couple of days, so the allegations about the whipping and blackmail of MPs by the Conservative whips, and then Nus Ghani coming forward with her account of what happened to her, what got said to her about her being a Muslim female minister and that being why she lost her job. How much do you think those two things are going to cut through as well? You know, it's notable if you look at the Labour Party, actually, and the issues that it's had with anti-Semitism. You know, the research was showing that actually in the run-up to the 2019 election, that was really starting to affect the Labour Party brand. Do you think the same will happen around the Conservative Party and Islamophobia? And with whipping, do you think people will just look at it and think, oh, that's just how Westminster works? Or do you think people will find it quite surprising?
I think it's back to that impression of the nasty party, isn't it? That's mm-hmm. the problem, which Theresa May said that was the Tory party's Achilles heel. And those things ultimately come from the top. I thought the most damning thing about what Nusrat Ghani said was that she had told the Prime Minister personally about what had happened to her and he hadn't taken it seriously, just on a human level, just on a sort of emotional intelligence, compassion level. If an employee had come to you and said, look, this happened to me, I was really upset about it, you would do something. But he didn't. And he also didn't take it seriously on a political level either. So I think that is very damning of him. And I think the other factor is that the fact that all these things are coming out and that the MPs have shown, you know, they no longer, if you like, respect the rules of the whipping operation, it shows that Boris Johnson's authority is I would say has evaporated, actually, over his party. It certainly is evaporating. And I mentioned in my column, I remember going to see a play a few years ago at the Almeida Theatre in North London. And the play started with a coin spinning in a bowl. And it was a play about called Mary Stuart, about Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots. And which way the coin landed determined which actor played which part. It was Juliet Stevenson and Leah Williams. And then when Elizabeth took up her role, when the actor took on that part, everyone else on the stage turned towards her. And it was just sort of very symbolic of the way that authority isn't taken by the leader. It's bestowed on a leader by those around mm-hmm. him or her. And I think at the moment you just see the Tory MPs turning their backs on Boris Johnson because they see the voters turning their backs on him.
What will be, so obviously when it comes to a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson, you know, he serves at the pleasure of the Conservative Parliamentary Party at the moment. And if, you know, the critical number of 54 MPs get their letters into the chair of the 1922 committee, then a vote of no confidence happens. And it's a, you know, it's a sort of strict kind of up down vote, I suppose. So MPs hold all the power in this situation, Conservative MPs. So I was just wondering what you kind of know or understand to be running through their heads as they're thinking about when and whether to act or not.
Well, the one thing that it has maybe holding them back is that they're not sure who should take over from Boris Johnson. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a Stop Truss brigade. There's a Is Rishi Ready brigade. And there's a kind of, there's an anxiety about any of his successors. But I think what's dangerous for the Prime Minister is that MPs are beginning to conclude that actually any of the potential candidates would be better than Boris Johnson, given his current poll ratings and his kind of lack of moral and political authority. And it isn't like when Theresa May was there and there was a sort of ideological reason for people to really oppose any of the alternative candidates. It's more a sort of personality issue. So I think that's what's running through their minds, and they're all calculating: do I publicly pull the trigger now? What's in my interest? But they're also ultimately thinking about their own political survival, and they're looking at they're listening to their constituents. They're looking at the email inboxes, which are absolutely full of complaints about the Downing Street parties and Boris Johnson's behaviour. And they're thinking, I'm not going to be an MP anymore if we keep this man as leader.
Mm-hmm. And you talked in your piece about Boris Johnson retoxifying the Conservative brand. How much do you think this is going to linger, the sort of scandal of this is going to linger beyond Boris Johnson being in number 10 and affect his successors?
I think it depends quite how long this keeps going. But I know, certainly speaking to Tory MPs, they're very worried about the retoxifying effect of all of this, because it plays, the Downing Street Party's issue, while trivial, plays into this wider question of whose side are the Tories on. And the kind of killer problem for the Conservative Party has always historically been that they're not seen as being on the side of ordinary people, if you like. They're seen as the party of the rich, party of the establishment, the party of nice parties in Westminster Gardens, rather than the party of the workers and the people up and down the country. And so that's certainly what MPs fear, is that this is rapidly reminding everything, as one MP said to me, it's reminding us of everything everybody hates about us. And it's that sense, I think, is very strongly in their mind as well as they're thinking about what to do about Boris Johnson. Mm.
And who do you think is most likely to succeed him?
That's really hard to say. I think Rishi Sunak is certainly the favourite, I would have thought, at the moment. But often, in fact, usually, it isn't the favourite who wins. Liz Truss will certainly be running, although there are a lot of MPs who are very keen not to have another, blonde bombshell who's slightly unclear of what they stand for. I think also it's worth keeping an eye on Sajid Javid and Nadeem Zahawi, who might come through the middle as sort of competence candidates. They both would be less controversial, perhaps, than either of those two front runners. And Jeremy Hunt is obviously still keen to put his name forward, I think. I spoke to one former cabinet minister who said he had a real sense of buyer's remorse about not backing Jeremy Hunt last time around. So he thought there might be quite a strong constituency in his favour. But of course, the MPs whittle it down to two candidates to go out to the party. And ultimately, it'd be interesting, who do the MPs... I think if Liz Truss got to those final two, she'd be in a strong position. So there'll be a lot of MPs trying to stop her getting to those final two.
And one of the things that Boris Johnson did to sort of get his big majority back in December 2019 was to really use Brexit to appeal to people who'd voted Labour all their lives and were perhaps voting Conservative for the first time in areas of the country that may never have returned a Tory MP before, where that's very rare. Do you think any of his potential successors have got a chance of, if not replicating quite that level of success, because that would be very unusual between general elections, but of doing the same sort of thing to maintain a Conservative majority at the next general election?
It's much harder, isn't it? Because Brexit has happened. So the sort of get Brexit done argument has gone. And also Keir Starmer is no Jeremy Corbyn. So he's a much less frightening to many voters opponent. So I think whoever takes over from Boris Johnson is going to have a tougher time. But I think the danger for Keir Starmer is that if it is somebody more competent appearing, less flamboyant, less risky than Boris Johnson, then that removes his unique selling point, if you like, and that he needs to have some kind of political definition beyond just Mr. Sensible, Mr. Competent, Mr. Dull.
Great. And finally, just before we sort of kind of wrap this up, I wanted to ask you about Labour and what Labour's doing. Is it playing it right in this crisis that's befallen the government? Should it be doing more? And how likely is Labour to sort of benefit from this?
I think it's quite difficult for Labour because obviously there's a political temptation to try and capitalise on the Prime Minister's difficulties. But on the other hand, Keir Starmer as leader needs to look dignified and he needs to look as if he's got something positive to say. In the end, I think the next election will be determined by who has the most credible future plan rather than who, you know, the rows over Downing Street parties or Downing Street wallpaper. Tony Blair made a really interesting speech last week talking about the importance of having a plan, and actually, you know, there are these huge challenges coming to the country and none of the political parties really have any plan to deal with them. And I think for Labour to really cut through, it needs to rise above the sort of day-to-day politics and have something substantial to say on the issues that people care about.
That's a really good note to end on. Thank you very much, Rachel, for joining us. That was a really fascinating chat and for sharing your insights with us. And thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to hear our discussion. This episode was produced by Sarah Collins. If you enjoyed this podcast, escape the echo chamber and look out for the next issue of Prospect magazine, which is available on newsstands this Thursday, or go to subscription.prospectmagazine.co.uk to subscribe, where you can get 3 issues for just £5. So that's all for me. Goodbye, stay safe, and listen out for the next episode of the Prospect interview, which will be out next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.